So all the people that have normalized being able to talk about a mental health issue is absolutely amazing. And I think where my value will come in, or where Fettle can help, is that I think there's just about another gap to be bridged, and that is to normalize a solution. So it's normalized talking to a therapist.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Richard Stafford. Richard is the CEO and founder of Fettle.ie, an online therapy hub. The music in this podcast has been shortened for rights reason. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. The show is also broadcast weekly on Near FM and Flirt FM. For more information, please visit andreasplendori.com. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while. Been so long now.
So there you go, Richard Stafford. Thanks a million for joining me on the Social Fabric podcast. And we had a brief conversation last week, so kind of know a tiny bit about you, but I guess, like I do a lot of the times, let's go back to it. The early years of Richard. Where are you from? Tell us a bit about you.
So thanks very much, Andrea, and I really appreciate you having me on today, and I'm looking forward to having our chat. So my background is I'm born and raised in Wexford, and I've spent a couple of decades kind of working in different places, New York and Canada, primarily in Dublin, and working in the software tech industry. And then last year, I just at the start of COVID, took a bit of a career change, and I launched for the Irish public back in April of this year, a mental health platform called Fettle, Fettle.ie. And we provide online counseling sessions through our network of accredited and qualified therapists. So just through some of our mutual connections, as I say, we picked up the other day. So I'm looking forward to having a chat around myself and my own background. It's quite varied, like most of your guests, and I've had the pleasure of listening to a few of them, and I've really enjoyed it.
Brilliant. And that's what I like. I like the varied. I think I described it a few times as crossroads. You know, we're on a path, and then we get to a crossroad. We take the right turn, and we take the wrong turn. We take a turn at some point, and I think that's where most of us have been on this planet for over 20 years. You know, we have a bit of a story to tell. So Wexford, give us a background. Give us a little bit about. We get to Fettle later on, because I think your stories kind of will inform the listeners to what it is Fettle and what you're trying to do with it. But give us a bit of Wexford. What it's like as a kid in whatever, mid-80s, I suppose, mid-90s or something?
So I was born in 1980, and I turned 41 a couple of weeks ago. And I had a big turning point in my life, just a couple of months short of my 40th birthday. So I was back living in Wexford after traveling and working abroad. But for me, my life was one long emergency, is the best way to put it. I kind of lurched from disaster to disaster in certain areas. And it's funny because I walked a kind of a tightrope or a thin line between a professional career for many years with kind of great successes and great experiences working for great companies. But to go back to, I suppose, where this sort of double life almost in one way, if you want, came from was, so my life got upended when I was 10, 11, 12, and I was the victim of sexual abuse, which rolled into my poor mom having a long illness with cancer and passing away when I was 15. Now, when I first discovered alcohol, I was probably the angriest, most frustrated 15, 16-year-old guy that you could meet, you know. And in my 30s, I was diagnosed as having ADHD. So I didn't get on well with school. It was put down to, you know, his mom has passed away. Nobody knew anything about the abuse that I had suffered. And I started drinking. And I suppose the best way for me to describe that is I never came up for air. So once I first started boozing, that was it. I was gone. I didn't come up for air again for the guts of 30 years, a quarter of a century. And in that time, my drinking really, I suppose the best way to describe it is, like a prize fighter getting into a ring when I first started. I had all my family and friends and career aspects and college education and all the things that everybody thinks is mapped out in front of them all sitting around me in the crowd looking at me, and I kind of get hit and I get back up again. And, you know, gradually people begin to kind of leave the room or where the fight is or the auditorium or whatever, and they disappear one by one, and you're kind of slowly looking up and this group of friends have gone and that group of friends have gone. You've stopped playing sport. You're kind of moving around a bit. And I would have done a lot of geographical type changes. So I would have, kind of left thinking, look, no, I'll try something different. I'll try somewhere different. And possibly I will be different. But obviously I won't, because I take myself with me wherever I go. I take my head with me. And it took a long time of, I was in treatment a couple of times. And it took a long time to accept that I just could not drink. And I did for a couple of years in my late 20s, and I stopped for a couple of years, and things went really good. Career was good, work was good. But for me, the wheels kind of came off about 3 or 4 years ago. I started, I'd always thought my life was, a long, endless journey in front of me where, it'll be okay. You've plenty of time. And I became a little bit more aware of, I'm not young anymore. I'm in my late 30s here now. And I don't have an endless road kind of ahead of me. And I can't keep kind of making excuses. And I suppose I kind of got a bit of an awakening or a bit of clarity on where I was or where I was going. I was in a long-term fantastic relationship that had broken down. And I had been in a hospital again in treatment for alcoholism. And that's when I decided to kind of come around and talk a little bit more about the abuse. So with a lot of help there from Professor O'Gara in St. John of God's, who was absolutely fantastic, and all the team around him, we kind of analyzed and said, look, I had suffered a re-traumatization of the abuse that I had, because I was in a very loving relationship and considering settling down. And this had brought up a lot of feelings in me, and I had it kind of buried for a long number of years. And really the kind of wheels came off. Now, I'm still maintaining quite a good career. As I say, I was working for very large multinational technology companies, lots of travel, lots of successes. There was one occasion where I had won what they call President's Club in Oracle, where they fly you out to Hawaii for a week. And the entertainment for the week was a couple of private concerts. One was with Stevie Wonder. So, really highs of work and the highs of travel. But behind all of that, there was like lurching. I'm one minute I'm standing on the beach in Honolulu listening to Stevie Wonder, and my car isn't taxed at home kind of thing, or struggling to kind of make ends meet. So essentially I kind of, as I say, wound up in a situation where my health was beginning to suffer. I was in hospital a little bit more. I developed a thing called bilateral foot drop, which is a kind of a temporary paralysis on the front of your feet, a peroneal nerve. You can get it from bad living, hard living, like not eating properly, kind of blood poisoning and things like that. And essentially I was back in Wexford, and after, summing up here kind of, I suppose, the guts of 25 years of very hard living, I reached a point. Now, I'm in a 12-step recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I reached a point, what they call a jumping off point. And it's essentially where I really didn't see any future with alcohol or without alcohol. It's a very scary place to be. There was almost a resigned sort of acceptance to it at the same time. But you had spent so long making promises and failing on promises and hoping and the best intentions, building up a house of cards continuously, and giving hope to the people around you that love you, that support you, that this time may be different, and then just crashing the whole thing down. Normally when things were going quite well, and to say it in a modest but in a confident way about myself, I've always done okay when things are going well. I had good instincts for the job that I do. I was quite successful in that. But essentially, it was very disappointing to continuously kind of fail in in the fact that I just couldn't stay away from alcohol. So I wound up in this jumping off point. And after many years of suicidal kind of ideation, I cut my wrists. So I'm sitting there and I decide, no, after a while, I'm kind of covered in blood and I ring an ambulance. The ambulance come, they pick me up, they bring me to the hospital and I get sewn up. I look at the scars on my wrists today, you know, as I work and as I'm working very hard, and it's gives me a lot of motivation. But I kind of wandered around for a couple of weeks after that and basically got help from the people I knew previously in Alcoholics Anonymous and from some of my friends. And something, I suppose, kind of stirred in me. Pain is a great persuader. You know, I always considered I had lots of road ahead of me in terms of life, but closing in on 40, that kind of put that to bed a little bit. And as I say, there was no future with alcohol. I decided to give a future without alcohol a chance and reached out, asked for help. So got help from people in recovery, got help, started counseling with the Rape Crisis Center, began to make amends to the people around me, including my partner, Alessandra, who, you know, we got back together again, which is one of the biggest miracles for me for recovery. And things have started to kind of look up. And the way I would look at it, I suppose you can call it several things. People call being reborn again, or coming out of a nightmare, or coming out of a fog. But I never felt that I had ever come up for air before. So to kind of view the world with a little bit more peace of mind and clarity in terms of, you know, I think I mentioned to you when we previously spoke that I'm accepted onto an entrepreneur's program with Enterprise Ireland called New Frontiers. It's been delivered virtually, but the first day that we were kind of logging on, I kind of had a little burst of pride and interest and enthusiasm, and I'm looking forward to this. And I was kind of smiling to myself going, this must be what people feel like if they're starting college or if they're starting a new job. Nothing ever mattered to me. Nothing. I didn't care. You know, I cared and I didn't, and I was self-destructive and I was defiant and I was angry and I was resentful. And everything I ever did was around time. And I think I've mentioned in one of my songs that I popped over to you in a message from Pink Floyd. Everything I ever did, I wanted to be somewhere else. I didn't want to be there. You know, I wanted to be in a pub. What time is closing time? What time is the pub open at? My entire life was a slave to alcohol. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and found that jumping off point. Went to it, and as I say, have scarred myself from it. But it's a reminder for me of what's there. There's nothing there for me anymore. You know, but it took a long time, multiple continents, you know, fractured relationships, and, you know, a lot of distress to my family. So that's probably in a short space of time, 25 years of hurt, I suppose, is the best way to put it. But for me to kind of come out of that and to view the world in a different lens is enchanting, to be honest.
Wow. Well, first of all, congratulations on all that you've achieved at this stage. And most important, that you actually are back with your partner, which is fantastic. And best of luck with all of that. It's hats off, you know, and thanks a million for sharing all this. There's quite a lot in there. I want to go back on a couple of things. But before we do, you sent me three songs, which starts with Time, I guess. You just mentioned Time by Pink Floyd. Why did you pick that song?
So there could be hundreds of bands and hundreds of songs that are various times, but this song has stuck with me for as long as I've been listening to it, which is 30 years, I suppose. And it's just the lyrics to it, just the kind of it's brutal of how transient our life is on this planet. You know, the sun racing around to chase to up, come up behind us again, you know, one day shorter of breath and closer to death. It just nails you between the eyes as to how, you know, quick and fickle. And I think I read a book recently, and there was one a reference into it. I think it was an ancient English poem where a person said a man's life is like a bird flying in one door of a room and straight out another door, and it's just that going straight by you. And for me, that's probably the song that always sticks in my mind. Is the lyrics to it are fantastic.
I just want to go back a little bit, just not necessarily to but I'm just really curious of fact. Well, first of all, I love the fact that you opened up really quickly to this, as you describe it, 25 years of emergency coal, and it just describes it very quickly, very raw. But I love your self consciousness, the fact that you're talking about it so openly and so informed, and you know, I just love the way you express yourself, and it's fantastic to hear. But I want to go back to just the abuse, because it's such a big part of our history, and we keep hearing it every single day, and it doesn't seem to be going away. But, and I don't need to know the details, but what was the support then, and what has been the support? And I know you mentioned the rape crisis now, but for 20 odd years, how hard it was to talk about, and tell me a bit about that, because obviously that has had a major impact on everything else, the unfortunate death of your mother as well.
Yeah, there was probably a victim of very, I suppose, poorly timed events where my mom got sick after I'd been abused, and nothing ever came out, you know, nothing was ever said. I never talked to anybody, I never discussed it. In my 30s, I did begin to start to mention it to a couple of close friends, and I did kind of open up a little bit. But the support, that was it. I started to open up a little bit in treatment about it. And in terms of, and I do kind of a little bit conscious of what I'm saying, because the great thing around my journey for the last couple of years is that I went and made, you know, an allegation to the police, and there is a case with the guards, with the DPP. So won't go into too much detail, but essentially the support I got, and you know, I'm in a recovery group. I have shared, I've had other people come up to me and ask me, what was that process like after such a long time? You know, how do you go about talking to the guards, or, you know, going to the Rape Crisis Centre? So the Rape Crisis Centre has been fantastic, but there's a waiting list. You know, it's hard to, I suppose it's hard to get the help that you need. They're stretched in terms of their funding, in terms of just bandwidth. I had spent years kind of briefly mentioning the fact that there was abuse in my story to psychiatrists and psychologists. And they all stopped me and kind of said, before you go on, or before you mention any name here, we, you know, have to inform you that if you do mention a name, then I have to take this to the relevant authorities, to SLA and things like this. And I always kind of in my head thought that if I ever came up and said this, it's almost like a SWAT team is going to come in. They're going to go to that person's house. They're going to do this. None of that happened whatsoever. I found it a really distressing process, walking in off the street to walk up to a desk in the Garda station and say that he wanted to make a historical abuse allegation. I found it tremendously upsetting. Now, in retrospect, and the advice that I've given to other people are that there are dedicated units within An Garda Síochána that do look after historical abuse claims. Eventually, after a number of interviews and number of witness kind of statements, it was given over to them, and they were absolutely amazing. They were fantastic because it's their area of expertise. But just walking in off the street, I wouldn't advise somebody to maybe do it. There are, as I say, historical units there. It's still very current and it's ongoing for me. So, you know, it's by no means, so it's very kind of raw with me still at the moment, you know.
Okay. And I won't dwell on that. I'm curious about the, like the whole premises of this podcast is the communities, how we help each other, how we, you know, who's around us. And I know you say to me that you kind of, geographically, you kind of try to get away from things, you know, so you moved around thinking, you know, if I go to the States, if I go to Australia, if I go to wherever, I'll be fine, you know. But what was it when you were going through the, you know, the dark days of drinking and everything else? What was the community around like? What were your friends like? Was it easy? But anybody, what was it like? Because I know that's, we get to Fettle in a second, so that's what you, exactly what you're trying to do. You're trying to create that online community for people to get help. So I'm just curious to see what it was like for you. Who was around for you?
Again, I kind of, for a good few years, I kind of walked, and you change kind of community friends, you change groups of friends, you know, you're kind of living in different places. You have a local pub that becomes the focal point of your week. You're involved in other people's lives, but you're not friends with anybody. you know. So I wasn't good enough, I suppose, in one way to kind of maintain and hold on to the relationships of friends maybe that I had came from my area or had grown up with, if you want. But I wasn't bad enough either of a person to kind of sink to any sort of, like, I suppose, unhealthy or criminal type activities or something like that. I just drank a lot on my own. Just got in trouble in terms of financial trouble or in terms of work history. And basically, you know, the community aspect was that you would have kind of been a bit of a transient person, you know, involved in a few different groups and never really been longevity or never really staying around.
Okay, let's not dwell on that. Let's tell me about the Common People by Pulp. It's one of my favorite songs. It's such a great story.
Yeah. So exactly. And I think that's girl in real life, she's married to Yanis Varoufakis, isn't it? I butchered that pronunciation. The Greek ex-finance minister, a bit of a character, I think, the guy that goes around he's wearing leather jackets with all the global leaders and stuff. So apparently in real life, she's married to him. But for me, it's just an evergreen song. It's just fantastic. You know, you'll never live like Common People, kind of hear him snarling, almost like Bob Dylan, with, you know, how does it feel? And like a Rolling Stone kind of thing. And again, there could be dozens and dozens of songs from that era. But for that, just one just popped into my head.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her tank was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room with Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I want to live like common people.
Okay, so let's get to Fettle, because that's the important part. So, as I say, it's brilliant that you were accepted in this program. You took the bull by the horn, for wanting a better description, and you went for it. You created something that it's up and running, it's working, you've got some backing going on, and it's all happening in... I suppose, did it surprise you how quickly it took off? And so then tell us a bit about Fettle, because tell us what you're doing, what you're trying to do, and where it's going.
Yeah, so I mentioned my own online counselling. Online counselling saved my life, effectively. I had tried face-to-face counselling in the past. I found it expensive. It's too time-consuming. It was kind of a fragmented kind of approach. I'm a very kind of, you know, on edge most of the time anyway, and it would take me 20 minutes to kind of relax and sit down with somebody before we begin to open up. So just, I found face-to-face therapy never kind of fit in with me. I didn't know who the therapist was, maybe in advance. It's hard to build a therapeutic alliance. So I was concerned then when I started online counseling with the counselor that I had just mentioned, and I was kind of factoring, what am I going to do in the future here? You know, because it has had such a transformative experience in my life. And I began to look around in terms of, you know, what's out there at the moment. And I found that for me, it seemed to be the perfect marriage or combination of my personal life experiences and my professional background. So, yes, I want to give people easier access, more cost-effective and more affordable to the highest quality mental health professionals that are there. That's great, because I have had such a positive impact from building weekly therapy into my life. So there's a real stickiness to it when it's done virtually, because you're working away, it's in your calendar, you're not leaving the house. So that's fine to have that vision and to have that goal, but to actually execute on that. So I think it's General Omar Bradley, who was the famous Allied general in World War II, he had a famous saying that amateurs talk tactics and professionals talk logistics. So, you know, you can swap out logistics with, you know, how do you execute on this plan here? So it's one thing having that vision, but it's another thing to actually put it in place. And that is where my professional career comes in place, from terms of digital transformation, in terms of client acquisition and marketing, all the kind of commercial-esque element stuff of a business that seemed to be lacking in the therapy space. So I found that therapy seemed to live in an analog world where the websites didn't look great. You couldn't make a booking online. It was very expensive still. And it was just a poor customer journey. And I just felt, when I looked at some of the, I suppose, the I did a bit of research and looked at where the kind of market is in Ireland, if you want. And when I looked at that, it threw up some kind of interesting things for me. Like, so we have had so much Trojan work in terms of advocacy done and awareness around mental health over the last number of years. And I think it's very normalized to discuss, you know, that I've had an issue with mental health. And, you know, I would have never in my entire life been able to openly share that. Yeah, I'm an okay guy. I just can't touch a drink. You know, I didn't want those things to happen when I was younger, and it's deeply affected me. And I was a very sick person for a long time. And now I'm a sick person. I'm just trying to get well, you know. I'd have never, ever, 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 ever uttered those sort of words before. So all the people that have normalized being able to talk about a mental health issue is absolutely amazing. And I think where my value will come in, or where Fettle can help, is that I think there's just about another gap to be bridged, and that is to normalize a solution. So it's normalized talking to a therapist. You know, we talk to, I go to a physio, you go to yoga, you go to Pilates, you go to a doctor if you're feeling unwell. And I just think there's a little bit more has to be done just to normalize the solution. And all the kind of data would back that up. So the IACP, or the Irish Association for Counseling and Psychotherapy, had a great survey just before the pandemic where 9 out of 10 people in Ireland think therapy is a good idea if you're in any way struggling. And just over 50% of people at any given time will have various levels of stress or anxiety or depression, but only 1 out of 10, or 11% of people is the actual statistic, actually talk to a therapist. Now, what that says to me is that everybody kind of knows it's okay not to be okay, but there's an imbalance there, right? And what are the barriers as to why people aren't talking to a therapist? For me, there's kind of the main three are cost, access, and stigma. So I wanted to kind of address the stigma aspect by making Fettle look and feel like every other industry that we deal with on a daily basis. So not talking in the crisis-orientated way, not the usual kind of therapy messages, just make it look and feel normal and give everybody permission to talk to a therapist. And in terms of access, you know, you can view like unbelievably well-qualified, insured mental health professionals from all over Ireland. We see clients, Irish diaspora, that are living Australia, Norway, Canada, Dubai, are all using our platform. Because you have a greater choice, you can view exactly how the therapist is going to, you know, what areas they specialize in. You can get matched by a particular issue. You can have a look at what particular modality of therapy might be of interest to you. Perhaps it's maybe CBT. And you can go and view and get matched to a therapist that way, book your session, get your invite sent to you. It's delivered over the web through video, and it's all done in 7 or 8 clicks. So all the feedback that I've gathered from all of my clients, and we've several hundred that have weekly sessions with us, just thousands of sessions have been delivered at this stage. And just to go back, kind of one thing that you mentioned was, are you surprised maybe that it took off kind of quickly? Just think there's a need, a desire for something that was done a little bit more in a digital first way. We're all digital natives now, and it just seemed that therapy kind of lived in an analog world. But there is an interesting part that, if you'll kind of indulge me, that I just wanted to touch on briefly as well, is the therapist side of things. So with all the talk around mental health, you know, awareness and being more open around our mental health, one of the most interesting statistics, or where the lie of the land at the moment in terms of Ireland, is that 41% of Irish psychotherapists work less than 5 hours per week, and 70% work on a part-time basis. And again, this is all member surveys from the IACP. So you have this huge pool. That makes up literally thousands of unbelievably empathetic, very highly qualified, have spent 6-7 years getting qualified, tens of thousands of their own money, working in counselling for free and supervision, etc. And they can't get clients, you know, or it's not maybe necessarily to have a private practice, but they would love to see clients. So that's one of the real value adds that I first hadn't factored in when I started to look at this, as I was looking from a consumer's point of view or from a client's point of view. You know, I want to have easy access to a greater choice of therapists at a more affordable rate. But one of the real value adds is the relationship that I've built up with all the counsellors that work on Fettle. And I have a direct relationship with all of them. And it's just interesting that, you know, they're not trained or they're not educated in how to work in a digital world. So old referral funnels, in terms of GPs might be fractured, and it's not cost effective. So that's one of the most pleasing and you know, gratifying things, is that you're connecting not just the clients to get help, but also, you know, wonderfully empathetic. And I think they undersell themselves, which is one of their greatest strengths, is that they don't overpromise and underdeliver. You know, they're very quiet and they're very empathetic. And I'm almost wanting to try and shout for them a little bit harder to connect them to clients, because they're such wonderful and caring and highly qualified people.
Wonderful. A couple of questions for you. This is more on the technicalities, because I think it's really interesting. I guess what you're trying to do, and it's fantastic. There's already a nice pool of customers using your services. So I get it as a consumer. I go online, I go on Fettle, and I go, okay, I like Mr. X, psychotherapist. I like the look of him or her. I like what he stands for. I like his, et cetera, et cetera. I pick him or her, that's fine. From a psychotherapist and psychologist point of view, how do you bring him in? I mean, obviously they're all qualified. Is there a vetting process, or how do you do that?
Yeah, so very good question. And so we have an intake form. So when a client books a session with a therapist, they will complete an intake form, and things like age or gender, if you want to give it a location, and a few other things. We have our terms and conditions, etc. So when an appointment is booked, that automatically will get sent to the therapist. This intake form is the standard type of intake form that you would maybe do before you go into any sort of traditional face-to-face therapy clinic. Additionally, then outside of that, the therapists, depending on how they work themselves or what their own approach to working with a new client is, they may reach out and do another intake form. But as a standard, as a business, because essentially, as how we're structured, is that we take the initial intake form for the main requirements, if you want, in terms of information, that if, you know, a part of our terms and conditions.
Okay, that's fine. So that's kind of, I think, answered my question to a point. So what I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned, you know, how it saved your life, and I hear it, and it's great, and you look great, you look well. Maybe Sardinia's help is helping the tan, but you look in good shape. I can only see your shoulder and your head, but it's a good head, so that's good. I'm sure the rest is fine. But you mentioned the stigma, so not the in advice, but yeah, I mean, when do people should go and see a therapist in your opinion, looking at your journey, when should you have gone to see the therapist?
Well, it's okay, so there's a couple of things there that pop into my mind. Right. So right now in Ireland, as I mentioned, 11% of people talk to a therapist. In the UK, it's about 26 or 27%. In the US, it's 49%. So we're behind the curve. It's not like, you know, traditionally we are in lots of kind of uptake or adoption. I think COVID has essentially been 10 years of digital adoption in the last 10 months. But in terms of when to see a therapist, so I have a wider kind of thought or idea around the importance of therapy. Of course, there may be an incident in a person's life. There may be a specific need for a short-term kind of maybe grief counseling or some other issue that has come up. And a couple of sessions might suffice there, and it's to get somebody through a particularly difficult time. For me, I will be in therapy for the rest of my life, and I am absolutely delighted to be in therapy for the rest of my life. I have a professional problem solver and listener that wants, gives me a safe space and is empathetic to me and understands, has a good understanding of my story and my life. So for me, I believe that I think that the importance of a relationship with your therapist is only going to increase. So we live in an age which is essentially where humanity is living in an age of bewilderment, where we can't make sense of all the old stories just aren't true. We cannot make sense of the data that's in front of us at the moment or at our fingertips. You know, it's how do we know what we're digesting? Social media, you know, you call this the social fabric, social media in lots of ways has kind of torn the fabric of society apart in certain ways. You know, how do you get so much polarization? how do you trust anything that you're reading? I look at my phone, and I would like to say that I'm, you know, this sort of Zen type person that in the morning I have a routine. No, I'm probably awake during the night and I'm looking at my phone, you know, casually in the bed at like 4 o'clock. I'm angry, I'm jealous, I'm resentful, I'm happy maybe, but it's all within 10 seconds. And I think as technology disrupts how we live and work and our societies more and more over the coming years, that we see it in education. Education now has gone more towards and will in the future at the areas of collaboration and communication and creativity. And I just feel that the therapeutic hour, if you want, that we'll have with a therapist will become a really paramount part of our lives, because we're all electronically connected but emotionally disconnected. So for me, nobody wouldn't get any value or benefit from sitting down and talking to a professional for an hour. You know, it just depends whether it's a certain time of year. If you're an active person, okay, maybe I'll do a few months therapy during the winter. For me personally, it's every week. It's a cornerstone of my self-care. I am not a person that is very diligent around meditation or, you know, exercise or other things. I dip in and out and they're all fine. And it's just, this is one thing I've religiously stuck with because it's had such an important impact in my life.
And I won't disagree with you. And I'm in that space, although I'm doing coaching, I'm not doing therapy, and it is my business. But I'm more optimistic that as a society, we will look after each other a little bit more, that, you know, the likes of Richard doesn't need to be in therapy for the rest of his life, that this is society we are able to communicate. But that's my optimistic view of the world. But I hear what you're saying. If you're making it a lot easier for people to book a session, perhaps, you know, that dark journey that some people go through doesn't have to be that dark. Perhaps we can nip it in the bud much earlier. So hopefully that's the plan. Tell me about I Am the Resurrection. The Resurrection, Stone Roses. Not a great song.
Yeah. So again, probably if I was to immediately what was to pop into my head, and sometimes you kind of get a freeze or brain freeze around picking songs or movies. Arcade Fire or the Stone Roses will pop up, but this song in particular and this band in particular, I listened to all my youth, and then I got to see him one. I've seen him once, and it was I think it was like maybe the second or third date I had with Alessandra, and they played in the Phoenix Park in Dublin, and it was just, you know, a fantastic, memorable experience to see the band that you'd listened to for years that it broke up, you didn't think you were going to see, and then obviously to be beginning a new chapter of a very exciting chapter in my life. So that's why I've chosen that song.
Let's stick with that, the new exciting chapter. It is very exciting. It's fantastic. And you told me all about Fettle, and we'll put all the links in the show notes to it, and people can go and have a look, and you kind of gave us a good description of what it's all about. I had a walk through the website, and it's very straightforward to get to. I didn't click through, but it looks very straightforward. So, but tell me about this exciting chapter. Like you mentioned Alessandra a few times, well, you know, tell me a bit, the next 12 months, where are you going to be? Like, apart from Fessel being the main thing, the main psychotherapy hub in Ireland, where else do you see the Richard being? What would you like it to be?
Well, yeah, so the really exciting part for Fettle right now is that we have secured some outside investments. So we've three amazingly experienced angel investors. So we've now raised 225,000. And we are going to grow and scale. And like the really exciting thing is that the quicker we grow as a company, the more people we help. So very often, and I mentioned it quite a bit from my previous background of technology companies, become a little bit desensitized to some manufacturing company or something, you know, talking about we're going to change the world one industrial component at a time or something, you know. So it's a real absolute pleasure to actually be providing value. And I collect feedback from my clients, and it's really great to hear things like, I love the service, just simple, it's affordable, and it's really easy to use, and it's just super. The reminders are great, and the therapist, most importantly, the therapists are fantastic, and that's the really great thing, is that we spent a lot of time talking to therapists, having these sort of conversations, and they're all very happy working on the platform. But for me personally, so one thing I didn't mention is that despite all of the mayhem and despite all of the emergency, is that I've been quite active in terms of rock climbing for the last 15 years. I've climbed all over Europe, climbed in the States. I'm currently sitting here in Sardinia, but it's too warm right now to do any climbing. But I've climbed here for years and years, and during the winter, I would be hoping to move here and share and spread my time between here and between Ireland. So one of the amazing things for me is I was very focused on America when I was younger, when I was kind of in my teens, and I left Ireland when I was 18 to go there. Now, on numerous occasions I left, but I came back after a short period of time because things went haywire, because I brought myself, as I previously mentioned. But for me, there is a lot of climbing to be done. There's a lot of being outdoors. There's a lot of work to do. And I've found, as I say, that combination that I'm passionate about something. I was never passionate about anything. I looked at the world. I was a taker. What can I take? I deserve this. Or I was feeling sorry for myself. And the funny thing is, I mentioned kind of alcoholism, obviously, quite a lot, and the mayhem that goes along with that, and the destruction and the broken dreams and all the usual things. But the part that we don't kind of hear about a lot is there's a lot of downtime being an alcoholic, because you're broke half the time and you're sick half the time and you're in the bed. And for me, all I did was watch and read books and watch documentaries, and say Anthony Bourdain was very close to my heart, because he passed away tragically, at his own hands. And for me, his show was, I could spend hours watching that. Well, the whole world was falling down around me. So I've huge, huge bucket list of things to travel and to do. So I won't be wanting for ideas in the next few years.
Brilliant. And what's the peak? What's your dream peak to climb? The dream mountain to climb?
Yeah, the north face of the Eiger. That would be the dream one, I suppose if there's three of the three kind of different elements, that would be the main one, and maybe El Cap in Yosemite.
Nice. I walked El Cap. I never climbed it, but it's a fantastic place. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, your book recommendations, Anthony Beaver, Stalingrad. I have two or three of his books at home, and I started Berlin and never finished it. But he's quite a fascinating author when it comes to history. I never read Stalingrad. Tell me a bit about why did you pick it?
Yeah, so back to that, there's a lot of downtime when you're in addiction kind of idea. I happened on Lawrence Rees, an English historian, did a documentary series on Auschwitz. And I had watched it when I first watched it. I think it was maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13 years ago. I'm not sure, but I just set something off in me I had kind of not that much knowledge around World War II. And I ferociously basically read as much as I could and watched as much as I could. And Stalingrad is the one that will pop out to me. This war of annihilation, the scale of it, and the entire Operation Barbarossa or the Eastern Front. But some of the kind of things that I learned more and more and was more interested to learn around World War II. And some of the key kind of stories that pop out of Stalingrad, there was a painting called the Madonna of Stalingrad, and it was painted by one of the soldiers, the German soldiers, in the over Christmas of 42 and 43. And things were, they had been encircled at this stage. They were never going to be getting out of there. And this particular painting became a sort of a shrine for all of the soldiers. And it's like a charcoal drawing of a Madonna of holding a baby, and has like life, love written on it. And essentially it was deemed so important that it was flown out on the very last plane that managed to get out. But it's hanging in an old church in Berlin that's a museum. And I got to see it a couple of years ago. I was on a work trip, and I kind of made sure between all the everything that was going on to make sure that they got to have a look at it, you know. And I felt it was just fascinating. I mean, some of the other kind of fascinating stories from it that just blow my mind of the scale and what's involved was, you know, the commander of that 6th Army. And this is the army that encircled this 6th Army, you know, a few years earlier had been goose-stepping down the Champs-Élysées with Hitler looking over to him, you know. And then a couple of years later, they're of that 300,000, I think 6,000 never got back to Germany. But Friedrich von Paulus was the commander of that army. And Hitler promoted him to a field marshal with the expectation that he would do the honourable thing and shoot himself, because no German field marshal has ever been captured alive, basically, or surrendered. And his famous remark was, I won't shoot myself for that Bohemian corporal. So that was Hitler's rank in World War One. So just fascinating, the scale of it. And, you know, they're part of my list of things that I'm wanting to do over the next while, is to visit as many kind of significant sort of sites from World War II as possible. It's something I'm unbelievably passionate about.
Brilliant. Well, I'm delighted that you're not going to have any idle time between building this business and climbing the mountains and visiting all this. So fantastic. And once again, just really my hat off to you for setting up something that it's a great business, and I'm sure it's going to blossom into the proper business you want it to be, but it also is there for a purpose, and that's really the key. And look, best of luck with everything, and stay safe, stay healthy. And you never know, I might bump into you in Ireland one of these days when you come back, and we can have a coffee. And best of luck, and thanks a million for sharing the story. Really appreciate it.
Andrea, thanks so much for your time. Much appreciated.
I'm still rambling around the world with my songs and this guitar. Never got to sell 1 million. I'm still playing in bars, these shady, dim-lit bars. No, I heard it through the grapevine, you're to marry soon. All my love fell by the wayside. I guess that I'm a fool, a lonely rambling fool. But if I meet you somewhere far down the line, the sun still shines in your hair. I kiss you once, then I'll say goodbye. Yeah, if I meet you someplace far down the line, the sun still shines in your face. I'll kiss you once, then I'll sing.